guitar work of Michael Miles. I am the voice of Rick Cogan, and I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy until noon right here, and then from noon to 1 on WGNRadio.com. Some years ago, well, I feel in really good hands with Kevin Richter producing and my old, longtime Sunday Papers producer Bob Ferguson sitting here making everything work. My first guest I wrote about some years ago when he was really young. He was probably 19 at the time. His name is Malcolm London, and he was then a young poet, not quite the activist he is now, but he has become, in these 4 years, a prominent poet, an active activist, and a remarkable educator. Malcolm, how are you?
I'm good, Rick. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. Do you believe we've known each other all this time?
I cannot. It's been a pleasure.
You've grown up a lot, young man. I'll never forget when I wrote that story about you in 2012. You said something that has ever stuck in my mind. You said, "I do not do what I do for money. I come from a place with no money and don't expect I will ever have a lot of it. But I think that being a teacher and a poet can be a viable career." It has become a viable career for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely has. And I think I still believe that wholeheartedly, but then I grew up and had some bills to pay.
Exactly. You have to make some kind of living, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think integrity is a pretty expensive thing to have.
Sure.
Both rewarding and what it costs.
Now, when I met you all those many years ago, you lived in Austin. Do you still live in Austin?
I live in Garfield Park now.
Okay.
Which is not very far.
Tough neighborhoods that have been getting, even since, I think in 2012, you and I might have been hopeful that this city might have become a more peaceful place. It breaks my heart. It must break your heart that this city is still in such kind of chaos, doesn't it?
I mean, every day it does, but I think the perspective is still the same. The West Side is a tough place to live, but there's also tough people. And so I think that hope still exists for a lot of folks that one day it'll get better. And, taking it one day at a time. I think what helps me as an organizer and activist is that every day I see people who are actively fighting. And I think the powers that be, whether it's those who run the police stations or those who close the schools and those who misappropriate funds in this city, those are the people I lose hope in. But I do not lose hope in the young people in the city who every day, whether they see a funeral or someone go to prison, they still have hope in themselves and in the city, and that's why I think I love teaching and being an artist and doing poetry.
See, that's a remarkable statement, because it comes from you, who is a person who is on the ground, who lives in these neighborhoods, rather than, with all due respect to my fellow reporters and people, a lot of people, when there is tragedy in that neighborhood, in a sense, helicopter in, do the quick reporting, and then get out. But you live there, and it's so encouraging, Malcolm London, to hear you talk about hope that exists there. Because most of the people in those neighborhoods, you know this better than anybody, 99% of those people are simply trying to get by, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's very difficult. I mean, I grew up in this neighborhood in Austin, but I didn't create the poverty that I was born into. And every day I think people are just trying to survive. And I think no one in this city, no mother, no father, no grandmother, no grandpa, raises their child to be killed, nor raises their child to be a murderer. No one wants that. And I think, it becomes difficult, though, when you have conditions that you don't often know how to get out of.
Yeah, it's sad. We got to take a break, Malcolm, but hold on. I know you've got an event coming up at 11, so I'll get you out of here by 10:30. But I'm on the phone with poet, activist, and educator Malcolm London. You can get a whole bunch of stuff about Malcolm at malcolmlondon.com. I'm not going to embarrass you by spelling that for you. You're a smart audience. It's malcolmlondon.com. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Lovely guitar work of Michael Miles. I'll tell you more about Michael later, but I'm on the phone before he goes to an event, a TED Talk. Poet, activist, educator Malcolm Lundon. You can find more about him at malcolmlundon.com. What's the event today, Malcolm? What are you talking about?
Today I'm doing a TEDx talk at UIC about sort of my journey from being a young person who had a 1.9 GPA, and I wear that as a go watch most days, to, you know, becoming the man I am today, activist, organizer, rapper, poet.
Well, one of the things that changed your life around, you were at Lincoln Park High School, you were a sophomore, you were trying to be a rapper, you carried a notebook, but you found your life and your future in poetry when you sort of got involved with the whole gang at Louder Than a Bomb and Young Chicago Authors. That changed your life, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, it did. I think because, you know, I saw a space alternative to my regular educational space that allowed me to be autonomous and allowed me to have and feel like I had ownership of my own learning.
Well, and you then were the individual winner of one of the Louder Than a Bomb contests, and you got remember you got pretty friendly with Matt Damon for a while, didn't you? You still friends with
did,
Matt? You still friends with Matt?
I haven't talked to him in a while, but I've made a lot of friends.
Yeah, he thought you were the greatest. Well, one day he's going to make you a movie star. There's no question about it. You also, Malcolm, I think in the last few years, I mean, you've gotten not an unfortunate incident, you got kind of railroaded into a possible felony just by going out and protesting, didn't you? That must have been, you know, if nothing else, it must have punctuated the sort of inequities in this city when you were, you know, accused of hitting a cop or something. What was that all about?
Yeah, I think, in this country, unfortunately, when people stand up for what they believe in, they're often targeted. I was arrested and I think framed for punching a police officer. And the next day, thanks to the organizing community in Chicago, I was released free of all the charges and drive, et cetera. But I think for me, that moment has become, not necessarily a wake up call, but I've been organizing for 3 years. Fully, and I was in college and working full time at Young Chicago Authors, and it was just a lot of consuming, and I didn't get a chance to write as much as I'd love to. And so in that moment of, you know, essentially almost feeling like I almost died,
yeah,
it kind of reinvigorated why I started this work, and that was through an artistic lens. And so it kind of put me into space of remembering to tell the story and to capture the moment and not just only be in the streets, but also, you know, write the narrative so that people remember these stories, so that we don't just, you know, organize campaigns and then when they're over, people don't often hear about them. And so as an artist, I think it's our duty to tell our stories in front of our noses.
Well,
it's our duty to change the stories we tell.
There is undeniably, though, power in poetry. I think back to the 60s, and the poetry that was the most powerful were poetry in song. But I think what you do, Malcolm Lundon, with your poetry is you can give a voice to some of the issues and troubles that are plaguing not just this city, but this entire world. Don't you think that's poetry's mission?
Absolutely. Cornel West has said that poetry is the people's legislation. And I wholeheartedly believe that. I think that's beautiful.
Now, you're doing a lot of traveling, aren't you?
Yeah, I have. I'm actually about to go on tour April 20th. It begins here in Chicago at Chop Shop, which is 2033 North West North Avenue. So I'm super excited. There's 12 dates. I'm going from Detroit down to St. Louis, covering a couple Midwest cities. And this is as a musician and as a poet, but I'm still speaking and stuff, but I'm really excited about this tour. It's for my new project I dropped last year in October. It's called Opia, which means the ambiguous intensity of looking someone in the eye, which can feel both invasive and vulnerable. And so as an MC now, I wanted people, when they listen to my project, to feel like they were looking me in my eyes. And so if you're listening, you should go listen to it and get some honesty from a young man from Chicago.
Well, the other thing you do is you are an educator. You go into schools. I know a school you're going to next week. That must be invigorating. There's one thing to be on stage, Malcolm London. There's another thing to be in front of a crowd that doesn't know who you are and doesn't know what to expect. Yeah. But how is that different for you? Because I know you love being a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, it's still one of my favorite things to do. I think, you know, it's literally the funnest thing, I think, as a performer. You know, as an educator, you have to be a performer. Like you said, you know, I'm known in a lot of different spaces, but still in a sixth grade classroom somewhere in the city.
They're like, who's Malcolm London? Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the beauty of one, just not only impressing them and still having the vitality to do that, but also, you know, it's not about me. I mean, my art is a reflection, but it's my most favorite thing in the entire world is to be in front of.
Well, I'm going to let you get dressed or whatever you have to do to go to this UIC TED Talk. But one last question. You talked before about hope. And you do still see it everywhere. It must happen in you see it in your neighborhood, you see it when you perform, and you see it in the eyes of the young people you teach. Are you confident that we are working our way somehow to a better world and a better city?
Man, you know, most days I'm always hopeful, but I think, you know, the people that have impacted the world or who changed the world or have never assumed that they would, and so I think, you know, no one says we're going to change the world tomorrow and goes out and does it, but everyone who does say I'm going to do something in the world knows that if we don't do anything, then nothing will change.
And Malcolm London, you are not
continue to work.
Yeah, you are not just a poet, you're a philosopher. knock 'em dead at the TED Talk. I will see you soon. Again, this is Malcolm London. You can go to malcolmlondon.com. All of you in the Midwest, you can go see him as he begins his tour here in Chicago on the 20th. Malcolm, take care, and knock 'em dead at the TED Talk.
Thank you, Ray.
All right, take care. Ray. What a good guy. You think, Bob? I mean, I'm talking to Bob Ferguson. I'm talking to you, too, but I'm also talking to Bob. We got to take a break, then we'll get some news, and then we'll talk movies. That is the music of Michael Miles. I am Rick Cogan, doing my best to fill in for Bill and Wendy. I have a regular show on Sunday nights, and I usually write for the Tribune. And if you saw the Tribune this week, one of the most popular stories to run in the Tribune this week was a story about a guy named Sean Patrick Leonard who decided to make a movie. He decided to make a movie because... Why, Sean? Because you're an actor and you wanted to make a movie, huh?
It's part of the reason, sure. But I had a story to tell, and I think...
Well, it's a result of something that happened to you, basically.
It is. The night before New Year's Eve 2015, so about, 13 months ago, yeah. I was coming home, and some black ice was over the street, and I stepped wrong, slipped, fell, and shattered my leg. I was in the middle of the street, And on
you're lucky. I mean, you really, part of it was feeling lucky to be alive.
Absolutely. But I was also still in the middle of the street, so I needed to crawl home. I mean, I literally had to crawl home as I was screaming down the street for my wife to come help me. And I made it home. She was asleep. I got her up. She had to rush me to the emergency room, and I had surgery the next morning.
Well, one of the other things is you were at the time a stay-at-home dad taking care of your two little children, and you said if you think it's hard to be a stay-at-home dad with two legs, try it with one. And then one night in bed, you got the notion that what if one of the family members all of a sudden vanished? How would you cope? The film is called Rockabye. It is 12 minutes long. You can see a little clip of the film, just a little clip of the film, at ForkTheMan.com. And in that film, you will see a charming performance by another guest in the studio, young Samantha Jalloway. Samantha, how did you get in this movie?
I had to have an audition.
You did? Are you an actress by trade?
Yeah.
How old are you?
9.
You're 9. She is also in here with her mother, Jen. And one of the sort of, I think, chilling and sad at the same time, is when you came in, Hi, Jen.
Hi.
When you and Samantha came in to audition for this film, it was in the wake of your own terrible tragedy. What was that?
So when we got the script, I read through it and actually had to sit her down and talk to her about the content of the story because my husband had tragically passed in a construction accident in the January of
2016. Recently?
Yeah. And so, I wasn't sure if it would be something she would be able to do, if she wanted to go near a story like that, but she wanted to try. She felt like she could do a good job.
And why? And Samantha, you wanted to do it because you told Sean that you thought your daddy would want you to do this, didn't you?
Yes.
Wow. It's funny because your younger daughter, Ruby, didn't want to be in it because of the nature of the script. She would cry every time she read it. So, Samantha, obviously you, now that you're a movie star, are proud. Was it hard? I know you shot in one day, and you also worked with Sean Leonard's son, Jack. He was like your brother in the movie, right?
Yes.
Did you like him?
Yeah.
So you, wow, two stars who get along? There was no fighting and anything on the set? Was it hard to do this the part? I know it's only 12 minutes long, but it's a very sort of emotional 12 minutes. You have to really act in it, and you do a great job.
Yeah, it was kind of hard.
But you were happy when it was over? Did you get a treat when it was over? Did you? What did you get?
McDonald's.
You got McDonald's? You can say that on the radio. You can say. Now, have you done other acting before?
Yes, I was on a Disney commercial.
You were? Well, because you're a very cute kid. And again, you can see, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to see a short clip of this, it's called at ForkTheMan.com. That's the, Sean, in order to make this film, you wrote it in a kind of frenzy, I think.
Yeah, about 2 weeks.
And then you went about the business of trying, and even a 12-minute film is expensive. It's not, nothing is cheap in the cinema.
No, unfortunately it is.
How did you find this team at Fork the Man?
Actually, David Bradburn, who runs Fork the Man and directed the piece, I sent him the script to get notes. Because he had written a lot of screenplays and things like that. I'd actually met David at a film festival years earlier, and we got along really great, and we actually sat down a couple of times talking about we should work on something together one day. So when I sent him the script, he gave me notes, and he's like, hey, you may want to trim here. I didn't know anything about formatting a screenplay because I used to write plays.
Yeah,
so I wrote it like a
long
play.
Time in the theater.
Yeah, absolutely. So he said, hey, what do you want to do with this? And I said, well, I'd love to produce it, but I've been an actor for a long time. I've never done the whole process. said, well, you know, let me talk to my, you know, my producer.
My people.
Yeah, and he talked to Kia Houston, who was our great producer, and they jumped on board. They said, we love this story. These are the type of stories that we like to tell, and let's do it. You know, so we did a crowdfunding campaign. We had a benefit. We did all of these things leading up to actually the casting of it. Originally, my daughter, Ruby, was supposed to be in it, but after she did hear, you know, what this was about, she had actually memorized half of the script. Before she was like, I think I'm going to take a pass. So we had to have an open casting call. So we actually brought in, I was looking for a 4-year-old, you know, that basically was my daughter. And so we actually brought in about 15. We were supposed to have about 50.
Wow.
People show up.
15 and the role went to Samantha Jalloway.
Sure did.
What did you think when you saw her, or how did... Did you have to read in front of Sean? Did you have to, like, read from the script and stuff?
If I needed to, I would look at the script.
But otherwise, you just... What was it about Samantha, Sean?
I mean, she just knocked it out of the park. You know, she came in and she was prepared. There's a really... The scene that we asked her to prepare is pretty much the climax of the movie, in which she has to call me out on my...
My behaviors. Your misbehavior.
Yes, absolutely. And she was probably the only one that came up to me. And in it, I actually wrote that, you know, the little girl grabs my face and pulls me in and says, you know, Daddy, you need a timeout.
Yeah.
And she was the only one to do it. And, I mean, I was blown away. I sat back. She walked out of the room. I looked at David and Kia and said, that's our girl. And Jack was actually in the room, so they actually had them stand side by side, and it was uncanny how they looked, just like brother and sister.
Oh, yeah. There's no question about
that. I was like, oh, my God, this is...
Jen, given that you and the family were dealing with the recent loss of your husband, father, did you have any trepidation about Samantha doing this?
I was concerned up until the production meeting. I knew she was on board to do it, and she's really bright, and she loves to act. So I knew she'd do a good job, but I wasn't sure how some of the script would affect her when we were actually doing the movie. But during the production meeting, when Sean started screaming or, you know, yelling as part of the script, it was like we have six people or had six people in our house,
yeah.
And we yell, you know. I love, we yelled to be heard over the... So she was very comfortable with it. And my daughter, Rachel, who had come with, when we left, said that Sean reminded her of their dad. Same kind of personality and...
Well, that's... Maybe there... You know, because there is something... It's only 12 minutes long, but there is this emotional undercurrent in the movie that I think is really palpable. And now I'm understanding... Why? We're going to talk more with the young star, Samantha Jalloway, maybe even her sister, if her sister wants to give her impression of what the movie was all about. Her mother, Jennifer, and the filmmaker, writer. Well, you're not the director. You do everything else. He's the star. He's a co-producer. And he wrote the amazing script based sort of on his own experiences and imagining... If that had been worse, we'll be back with them after a short commercial break. That's the lovely guitar work of Michael Miles. The movie Rockabye, which is getting its first film festival premiere in a couple weeks at the Twisted Alley Festival, for which it's already been nominated for 3 awards, will be hitting the festival circuit. It stars Sean Patrick Leonard, but more importantly, it stars the young future. Who do you want? Who's your favorite actress, Samantha Jalloway?
I don't really have one. I like
my That's it. You should say, I'm my favorite actress. She is here with her mom and her sister, Rachel, and in a weird sort of confluence of tragedies, the movie is about a man who has lost his wife and he's trying to cope with being a single dad in the wake of a terrible accident. Also in studio is is Jennifer, the mom, and Rachel, the sister. There are 4 kids in the family.
Four kids.
Not to get too deep into this, but What was it like to cope with that tragedy? I can't. It's unimaginable to me. Your husband died in a construction accident, and you have four kids. You live in the suburbs, and the fact that you're all ambulatory and here is remarkable to me.
Well, and it ended up, it happened on January 2nd, and the media caught wind of it. So the older girls were with me, but Samantha and her brother Joey were at hockey. And before we had a chance to make it to the hospital to even be sure that it was my husband, it was already on the internet.
Ugh, what a horrible way to...
Media was all over. You know, we didn't want to tell the little kids at 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
But we ended up having to sneak them in the house past all of the different stations that came to the house to try to interview us. So, you know, every time we'd turn the TV on over that weekend, this was the story they were talking about. And unfortunately, the kids heard some details that they didn't need to hear. So it was, I mean, we were just in shock. We were
stunned.
Well,
you must be quite a woman. And the kids have got to be quite kids to cope with something as devastating and life-shattering as all of that. Was making the film in any way part of the healing process?
It was. It was incredibly therapeutic for two reasons. One is you don't come across a lot of people in this situation, and the kids are uncomfortable because they don't know how to act
and
what
relate.
To say.
Yeah.
So for Samantha to have an opportunity to be a part of another story that's similar to ours, and to see that some of the things happening in our house are normal under these circumstances, was amazing, as well as just talking and being in the situation, because you find yourself trying to escape it.
Jennifer, I have to think that it's that you are probably not as pill popping and drinking as the character in the. That would be bad, because Samantha has to solve. Samantha, who plays the daughter in the film, has to lay down the law to her dad to knock it off. Right. You also have one of the great opening scenes, and you can see a short clip of this, ladies and gentlemen, at fork theman.com. You can see a short clip, or if you go to my story that was in Tuesday's paper, you can find it too. Rachel, the older sister, you've done some modeling, and I can see why. What do you think of the movie? We'll get not an unbiased voice, but another voice. What do you think of the movie?
I think that it was really great to see it, and kind of hard, because this is the life that we are living.
Sure.
And we're all just trying to stick together and make it through.
How do you think your sister did?
Phenomenal.
You think she has a future in this business?
Definitely.
What do you think, Sean? I was charmed by the entire 12 minutes of it. You, my friend, are a very, very good actor, and it's a very emotional 12 minutes, there's no question about it. Samantha, what do you think of Sean's performance?
He did a great job.
Too kind.
So when you go to these, you're going to the film festival. If you win these three awards of best short drama, your acting is up for a nomination.
And the screenplay itself.
Wow, that's the.
Yeah, we are very excited, very humbled by the honor.
Russell Westbrook triple double here, man. What do you think for the future? What are you noodling around? I know you're going to be busy promoting this, but are you noodling around a next film?
Yeah, actually, I wrote another one. It was in response to the Women's March this past year, though it takes a totally different stance. It's called Nasty, so we're hoping to get that production off the ground later this summer into the fall, and then hopefully, you know, kind of do the same thing. I have a feature film that I'm writing currently that has some work to do, but the goal ultimately is to find funding and fundraisers and things like that so I can get that off the ground as well.
Samantha, you might become kind of the Diane Keaton to Sean Leonard's Woody Allen. You might get to be in
every one of his movies.
You might get to be in every one of his movies. Would that? Do you want to at your young age? What do you want to be when you grow up?
A movie star.
There you go. Perfect. Rachel, what are your aspirations at this young age?
I think that she'd do great.
Yeah. What do you want to do? You've done some modeling. You want to get in show biz or so?
I'm not sure. My plan is to be a psychologist.
Oh, good for you. And Jennifer Jolloway, I admire you tremendously. To hold everything together like this is really something. How are you?
It's been the first year, you're on autopilot. Once we hit the first anniversary, we've started the grief counseling, and it's kind of more difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have great kids and great support. So, you know, day by day.
You guys love your mom a ton, don't you?
Yeah.
Unconditionally.
Well, wait till you get a little older and turn teenagers.
Yes, I have one of those.
She has one of those.
They're like, Mom, get out of here.
That's right.
Get out of here. You are a lovely family. I'd love to meet the other kids. One's a hockey star.
We're in spring right now.
Okay.
So we play with the Geneva Cyclones.
Wow.
And
the other one has a driver's license?
The other one has a driver's license, but she's helping now.
Okay.
Which has made things a little bit easier because we've got dance, cheer, she fences, we have hockey. So we're busy.
Well, you seem like just meeting the three of you, you were a great family. And Sean, you and your wife Mercedes have done a remarkable job with those kids. I, frankly, can't imagine you as a stay-at-home dad. When I think of myself as like a little boy, I go, no. Get me another dad. But best of luck with the film. You can see, just find the Tribune from Tuesday and you'll read a long story about it. The story does not contain this kind of emotional punctuation mark that you, Jennifer Jolloway, have provided with your kids, Rachel and Samantha, about losing their father and your husband. And my deep, deep sympathies to you. But, you know, life does go on. And you seem to be doing a remarkable job. Sean, let me know what happens in, it's called Twister Alley Film Festival.
The Twister Alley Film Festival.
In Oklahoma. In
Woodward, Oklahoma.
Woodward, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
It's not the Cannes Film Festival, but that's
growing,
coming soon.
It's growing pretty fast.
That's
I
coming
will say
soon.
That. Absolutely.
Thank you all so much.
Thank
Have
you
a
so
lovely
much
spring.
Thank you so much for
all
having
right,
us.
All right, we'll be right back. It's the guitar work of Michael Miles. I'm the voice of Rick Cogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy. And it is a real treat for me to have in the studio with me Jack Guthman, a prominent, long time, he keeps telling me how long he's been doing this, long time real estate attorney in this town and one of the powers behind the Architectural Biennial, which will have its second debut in Chicago later this fall in what I find, and I'll get to it later, a fascinating, fascinating way because it strikes close to home. And on the phone we have Todd Palmer, who's the executive director of the Biennial. Gentlemen, welcome to the Bill and Wendy Show.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. The first one was very bold. It is kind of... You know, I will tell you, frankly, both gentlemen, that I cringe at our mayor's notion of, well, this, no matter what it is, because there are many, this will make us a world-class city, because I believe Chicago is a world-class city. But this is one of his notions that to have this biennial is another way to burnish the reputation of Chicago. I just consider it a great thing, apart from any notion of burnishing the reputation. I find it a great thing for the city of Chicago. Tell me I'm wrong, Jack.
You're not wrong at all. I give huge credit to the mayor, however.
Oh, sure.
It was the mayor's vision, to have yet another activity in Chicago to bring to Chicago, added luster. You mentioned that we are a great city. We're absolutely
no
a
question.
Great, we're a great city. But this is incremental. So we have a great city because we have great music. We have great art. We have great buildings. We happen to have a great championship baseball team.
Yes. Well, that you couldn't say that a year ago, but we can say it now.
I've been waiting 108 years.
Well, I haven't been waiting quite that long. Let me ask both of you, gentlemen, if there is, and Todd, you can get into this too, to my mind, there is not a more interesting, and or notable architectural city in the world, I know that's kind of hyperbolic, than Chicago. Todd, do you believe that?
Oh, absolutely. Chicago has long been a center for innovation and architecture, dating back, you know, to its origins and certainly the World's Fair in the late 19th century and all the way through the 20th century into the present. And architecture is one of the great attractions of tourists to Chicago.
No question. I'm looking, you know, Jack and I are both sitting here in the showcase studio looking out onto this astonishing gathering of buildings right at the Michigan Avenue and the river. When you two gentlemen organized the first of these, it was deemed pretty successful, which I think is a tough thing to do.
Let me make an observation. It was more successful than we could have ever expected.
How so?
Well, we had over 500,000 people visit the biennial centered at the Cultural Center. There were some other events around the city. But we had a dream. We had an idea. We thought Chicago was the appropriate place. When we were talking to people from around the world, they were actually saying to us, what took Chicago so long to have a biennial?
We talk to people, remind people of what, I certainly saw it, but what was the nature of the first one? Todd, if I had flown in from Stockholm when it was going on, where would I have gone and what would I have seen?
Well, you'd have certainly started your visit at the Cultural Center. You would have seen some projects imagining the future of architecture and really taking the temperature of what's innovative today from architects from around the world, including Chicago. And there were exhibits that looked at how nature creates architecture, these amazing spider webs in a dark room lit up that really captured a lot of people's imagination. Another project that was really inspiring was looking at just scale and how architects think. And transforming, say, a potato chip into an idea of architecture by placing a small-scale figure next to it. You would also see some very large-scale constructions.
Sure.
In the middle of the courtyard of the Cultural Center, there's this kind of imaginary circus, which you can't get into, but it also looks at how architecture inspires imagination in all of us.
Well, I thought it was a remarkable show, and as Jack said, it got rave reviews, which brings up the question, as you addressed it in a recent Blair Kamen column, the great Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for the Tribune, fears of the great dreaded sophomore slump. After you got over the euphoria of and undeniably successful on every level, numbers of visitors, critical response, you then sit down and I suppose, Todd Palmer and Jack Gutman, you sit down and say, okay, what do we do next?
Well, the first thing you do...
May not be that informal, but...
Well, you don't sit on your laurels. That's the first thing you don't do.
Sure.
You take nothing for granted.
Sure.
Particularly since, candidly, we had we sort of closed up the shop. We had no staff. We had no money. We had the idea that we could do this on a biennial basis. And so the first thing we did was we found outstanding artistic directors. I cannot rave enough about Sharon Johnston and Mark Lee. They're a married couple. They have an architectural firm in L.A. and in Hong Kong. They are ideal for this task. Why? Because they are respected practitioners. They have a very serious architectural practice, but they have always kept their hand in on, let's call it, the intellectual side of the business. They lecture widely. They're very involved at their alma mater, Harvard, but they lecture around the country. They lecture around the world. And so we picked people who had great reputations both on the intellectual side and on the practical side, and they knew where the new ideas are and will be.
Well, and also how to take, it's great to have a new idea, but to manifest that idea in something, You know what I mean? To manifest it in something physical vastly difficult.
It is, but I was really impressed with what they came back with. Make new history is our theme. What does that mean?
Yes.
It means that architects, for a period of time, when a new idea came along, a new genre, they turned their back on the past.
Yep.
Now architects are seeing the old in the new and the new in the old, and it's no longer turn your back on what was appropriate to do a generation ago or a decade ago. It's incorporating history into today's architecture.
You know what I find, both of you, before we take a little break, what I find very interesting about that whole notion is that's the way music behaves, that music, more so than ever, is not afraid of the past. It's an organic thing, and I think so is architecture, and to take what one loves or admires of the past and incorporate it into the new, it's a fabulous way to live and work. I'm on the phone with Todd Palmer, who is the executive director of the Biennial, which begins this fall.
September 16th.
September 16th. We're going to talk some more about it. And Jack Gutman, who is the chairman of the Biennial Board. So I've got the big 1-2 punch here. We got to take a short commercial break. And we'll talk about this year's, which strikes, as I might say, very close to home, because we are in a place called the Tribune Tower. Artwork of Michael Miles. This fall, in September, the second Chicago Architectural Biennial, they pronounce it differently in Italy, will take place at the Cultural Center. On the phone is Todd Palmer, the executive director, and in studios, Jack Gutman, the chairman. Todd, this one, and I keep alluding to it like it's some secret, the focus is taking the measure of the Tribune Tower, is it not?
One of the exciting projects, yes, I think that will captivate people's attention, is taking up this theme of make new history and inviting the public into architectural history, I think, is an opportunity to consider that every innovative and beautiful site in our city and around the world has a backstory that we can learn from and be inspired by. So in this case, we're taking a look at the tower that everyone's familiar with on Michigan Avenue. What folks may not know is that in 1922, the Chicago Tribune hosted a competition that brought the world's best minds in architecture and asked them to imagine how that site would be addressed through architecture. So you had a range of interpretations that in this biennial we're going to showcase some of those past ideas, but we're also inviting young architects from around the world, many of whom have never built a skyscraper, to respond and reimagine the tower. It'll be a quite astonishing array of larger-than-life models of towers.
Yeah, how tall are they going to be? I've read in here in the fabulous billet or press release. How tall are these models going to be?
Each one is 16 feet tall.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, very. I mean, not as imposing as the tower itself. And, you know, the other amazing thing about it, I mean, the fact that the tower has been, I mean, there are all sorts of things going on. The tower and the surrounding property has been sold and parts of it will be redeveloped. I think it is going to. And I think you're right. There are a lot of people who do not know about that famous contest to house a bunch of reporters and ink-stained wretches we have. What do you think? Just you're an architect and know architecture. What do you think of the Tribune Tower, Todd Palmer?
I think it's a beautiful landmark for the city. And I think what's interesting is that we tend to take our landmarks for granted.
No question.
And to understand that part of, I believe the architects of it are actually from New York, but part of Chicago's greatness as a global site of architecture has been its openness to bringing the world to think about our challenges and the opportunities that an architectural building represents.
Was it hard for you and Jack to and your other colleagues to conceptualize this idea? Did you bang around other sorts of ideas too for the second?
Well, let's be very careful because we are the administrative.
Well, you're a
side.
Lawyer, of course. You have to be very careful.
Well, no. Particularly in the landmarks area where I have been faulted, I am aware. But the artistic directors are in charge of and have shaped the artistic side. It's up to Todd and myself to be the administrative arm. He's doing a terrific job pulling all the disparate parts together.
Sure.
I'm out with my tin cup.
Yep.
Raising about $6.5 million
wow.
is our budget. We're well underway, well along the way. But the idea of the competition, another aspect, the blending of art and architecture is another area that Sharon Johnston and Mark Lee are very keen on. They're avid collectors. They're avid proponents of visual arts, and they understand, and this comes to mind because I'm also on the board of the MCA Chicago, the blending of artistic pursuits.
Yeah,
and that you will see in the biennial as well. You will see the blending of art and architecture.
The other interesting aspect of this second year for me, and a hopeful and lovely aspect, is this community outreach that is going to be initiated. Talk about that for a couple minutes, Jack.
Well, it seemed to me in reflection of the after the first event that we had done a terrific job downtown. I didn't think we had brought the biennial into the communities as mm-hmm. well as we might. And I'm not just talking about outreach to schools and libraries.
Yeah,
we had
right,
done
right,
that.
Right.
We're doing that again. I have the advantage of knowing the arts community here. I knew that Sharon and Mark could not curate other shows.
Yeah, they're not.
But I chose to go to six institutions that have their own curatorial staff, their own program, their own mission. And I said to the directors of each of these, if we are able to give you a small amount of financial help, can you mount an architectural show in your building when we are up downtown that will be within your focus?
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, when I suggested $30,000 might be available to each one, they said yes. We have six interesting programs coming up in six different locations around the city.
I'll name them here.
And please, but I want to give credit.
Sure.
I went to see Terry Mazzani at the Chicago Community Trust, and I told him about this, and the trust is paying for that.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's a great combination of a great Chicago institution philanthropy and six local museums.
They are the and I've been to all of these. I love these places. The Beverly Art Center, the DePaul Art Museum, which is relatively new but also very snazzy, the DuSabo Museum of African American History, the Hyde Park Art Center, the National Museum of Mexican Art, and the National Museum of Puerto Rican Arts and Culture. You can get all sorts of information by going to Chicago Architecture Biennial. That's BIENNIAL.org. There's no sophomore slump for you guys. Jack, it's always great to see you. And Todd, it's lovely to meet you on the phone. And as much as you say, well, you know, the self-effacing lawyer here is like, well, we're just administrators. You guys are invested artistically and creatively in this as well. And for that, I greatly admire you. And this community outreach thing is something that's going to kick it, I really believe, to another level. Jack, it's great to see you. And Todd, great to meet you on the phone.
Thank you.
Likewise.
My pleasure. Knock 'em dead, guys. It happens this fall. So go to that website. You have more than enough time to plan, and I'll be right back. That's the guitar work of Michael Miles. I'll tell you more about him when I go to live stream at this show, the Bill and Wendy Show. I'm Rick Kogan filling in for those two fine folks. From noon to one, I'll be on WGNradio.com, or you can connect with the WGN app. It is my great pleasure in here to have my friend, dear friend, Renee Rosen, author of now 5 books. The first one, Every Crooked Pot, resulted in arguably the worst radio show I've ever had in my life. Renee is incredibly personable and incredibly nice, and it was like, so, was it hard to write this book, Renee? No. It's a very good book. Thank you.
Look at her now. She was terrified.
Also in here, and I'm really pleased to see him, is Terry Chess, the son of Phil and the nephew of Leonard, the guys who ran Chess Records. Terry, how are you?
Good, thank you.
You had to be... Renee has distinguished herself by, and after that first book, of finding a very interesting niche here that no other Chicago author that I know of is mining as effectively writing historical novels. They have been Dollface about gangsterism, which would appeal to my engineer here, Bob Ferguson. What the Lady Wants, which would appeal to my father, who wrote a book called Give the Lady What She Wants, and White Collar Girl. This one, Renee, Windy City Blues, your latest, is arguably your best. And you must feel a sense of growing with each book, or no?
Yeah, this book was the most difficult to write, and a bit of a departure in the sense that I had tried this book. I probably wrote about 200 pages and trashed it because, as in my other books where I have a female protagonist, sure, I tried to do the same thing with this. So I had Liba, this young Polish-Jewish immigrant who works for Chess Records. I was trying to tell the story just from her point of view. I was ending up with the Forrest Gump syndrome, you know, where she's showing up in all these scenes that she doesn't belong in. And finally, literally after about 200 pages, the light bulb went off and I realized the blues is too big to tell just from one character's point of view. I needed Leonard Chess to tell the industry side. I needed a bluesman. So that was Red Dupree, who is a guitarist who comes up from the Delta. And I needed Liba. So it was the most complex, but also, for me, the most rewarding.
Well, you do. I mean, without argument, is what distinguishes and elevates these books. And intense research. How did you meet Terry?
I met Terry. I was actually at an event talking about White Collar Girl, and somebody said, what are you working on next? And I said, I'm starting a book on Chess Records. And
Terry was in the audience and said, don't you dare. Well, what's the matter with you? I know this story.
I think when Terry first found out, you know, I was introduced to Terry through someone who said, do you know Pam Chess? I said, no, but I think I'd like to. And put me in touch with Terry. But I think when you first heard I was doing a novel, I think you were a little like,
skeptical.
How's that going to work?
Yeah, oh, another book about Chess Records? You know,
Well, there have been. I mean, that's the thing. There have been any number of them, and any number of books that will toss in a portion about Chess Records.
Correct.
Which used to be, if my Alzheimer's hasn't kicked in, 2021, South Michigan,
21-20.
Yeah. Close. So I'm dyslexic. I don't have Alzheimer's.
That's okay. You're forgiven.
I'm just dyslexic. The building is still, of course, there. Uh-huh. When you were a young man, what was your experience with your father and uncle's business?
Really, my experience, well, other than the fact that they would take me down there to look at some of the recording sessions, which were classic.
Ugh.
You know, I saw Chuck Berry record Sweet Little 16. I saw Etta James singing. I saw the Stones recording there. But other than that, a lot of my experience was working in the stock room packing records. When you start at the bottom of Chess Records, you really start at the bottom.
the legacy is profound, and I'm just thinking that the Rolling Stones exhibit is opening at Navy Pier next week, and that when the Rolling Stones had their first American tour, they came to 8 cities, not Chicago, but during that tour, they made it a point to come to Chess Records to record their second album, which features a song in homage to the place. The legacy of this, Renee Rosen, weighs heavy on anybody trying to write a book about this, does it not?
Oh, there were times that, you know, I was just so overwhelmed. And I was not really a blues person before I started this. So I had a lot of catching up to do, and such a great appreciation, respect for the music and the influence that it exercised on all genres of music to come.
Well, weren't you also amazed at the stature of Chess Records? Because, you know, in Memphis, they've got a, you can go on a tour of Sun Records, and okay, they did this here, and this here. There's no studio, to my mind, in the world that can rival, I'm asking you, Terry, that can rival the heavy legacy of Chess Records. Am I?
I think you're right. What really hit me about it, just about a week or two ago, I was watching Netflix, the documentary about Keith Richards.
Yeah.
And there's a portion in there where he's in Chicago, he's at the studio, and he looks at the camera and he says, I've been all over the world and seen a million different addresses, but the only one I remember is 2120. And I'm sitting there, and maybe it's because my father passed away recently. In
right,
October,
like last year, yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm getting teary-eyed because there are so many people who just look at the studio like it's Mecca.
Well, I think it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is. The building still stands.
It's
Blues Foundation that does some kind of outreach work to, you know, impoverished old blues singers and tries to help young blues singers. Renee, I'm not going to do it. I've read it, but you're the author. Detail your the plot of this book, which is beyond compelling.
Thank you. I think the Chess Records story in and of itself is just a great story. You have two Polish Jewish immigrants that come here. They have no musical abilities of their own. They don't play, they don't read music, and yet they are such savvy businessmen. They recognize that there is a need. No one is producing what was called race records or the precursor of R&B.
Sure.
And they see an opportunity. They form a record label and go on to produce Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, Chuck Berry, Etta James, Coco Taylor. I mean, it just goes on. And Willie Dixon, of course.
Everybody.
And so that, to me, was just... And the
that's
brothers,
a wonderful... I mean, for you as a novelist, that's a wonderful foundation because it's something you can really build on, right?
So I used that as the cornerstone. And then... I have this young girl, Leba, who had, you know, Forrest Gump started the whole thing off. And, you know, she comes from an Orthodox Jewish family. She goes to work at Chess Records and has some musical talents of her own. She plays by ear and such. And she falls in love with a bluesman from the Delta. And as a mixed couple in segregated Chicago in the 50s, it led right into the civil rights movement. And I think what surprised me, a couple things really surprised me about this book, but one was just how much the music was interconnected with what was happening socially.
Oh, no question.
And, you know, you just had both of those really developing kind of side by side.
What did you think of the book, Terry, when you finally read it? Or would you let him read it as you were going along?
I gave Terry and also his sister Pam a galley when I had them, and I was nervous. I was schwitzing, let me tell you.
And so what did you think?
I was pleasantly surprised.
That's
because
right.
I thought it was going to be – I don't know what I thought it was going to be, actually. I just thought that, you know, how can she – do any more, even in a fictional kind of a thing. But here's the thing about the book that really struck me, which tells me it's a great book. I lived a lot of the stuff that's in this book. You know, I mean, I was at some of the things that she drew on research, she drew on actual events, Renee did, and put them in the book. And even though I was there and I lived a lot of this stuff, I found myself turning the pages, like, what's going to happen next?
That is a great endorsement.
It really is. I mean, it was. She really had me on edge. What's going to happen with Leba? What's going to happen with Red? You know, the parts with the civil rights demonstrations. It was a gripping book, and I was really pleasantly surprised.
Well, that's a good endorsement.
Yeah, thank
you,
Terry.
We got to take a short little break, and I'll be back with Terry Chess and author Renee Rosen. Thank you. or Michael Miles from noon to one when I'm streaming on WGNRadio.com. But I have some more minutes with Renee Rosen, the most noted historical novelist in Chicago, because she has a bookshelf, a building, Dollface, What the Lady Wants, White Collar Girl, Every Crooked Pot is Not a Historical Novel, and most recently, Windy City Blues, which takes the measure of the incredible blues scene here against the backdrop of the civil rights movement, and they kind of actually crisscross, not just a backdrop. And Terry Chess, the nephew and son of the Chess brothers, Leonard and Phil. Terry, what do you think, if I can leave the novel for a second, what do you think of the notion of this new proposed blues museum in the middle of the loop? I'll tell you what I think. I think it's a lousy idea. I do.
I kind of like the idea, but what I don't like about it is that they're recreating the Chess studio supposedly at the museum. Why? I mean, they should be
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the original is here. That's what they should be doing something with. And I know that the Dixon family has been trying to get the funds to, you know, bring that up to snuff and get more people in. And, I mean, it should have been money that's been raised to help the Dixon family out to keep the original studio as the focus, not some recreation.
I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. And I couldn't agree with you more. I've been to Sun Studios, and you can walk into the Chess Studios, which still exist, and with a little dough. You know, but most of what I remember about Sun Records is it's cleaner and nicer, and they have more souvenirs for sale. That's basically...
And they have a chess display in Sun Studio.
Right. You know? I know. What's been the reception to the book, Renee? There's still a pretty vibrant blues community here.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed about this book is that, you know, people who have read my other books or people who like historical fiction may not necessarily consider themselves interested in blues or blues fans. And so the feedback of, I had no idea,
has
been really wonderful. And, you know, people that had no idea the music that came out of Chicago. I mean, even things like the Beatles' first U.S. single,
sure,
you know, came out of Chicago, or that we had Record Row down on South Michigan Avenue. So I think the discovery of the blues for people who didn't know anything about it, you know, and people who think blues is jazz and jazz is blues,
right,
they don't get that they're two separate. So that's been really rewarding.
Terry, what do you think of the, what do you do now?
Not much.
I don't blame you. I do the same thing.
I do real estate part-time just to keep myself busy.
Do you still, I mean, I know that the blues was not in the genes of your dad and Uncle Leonard and Phil, but are you a huge blues fan?
Yes. I mean, I grew up with it.
And
when I was riding in the car with my dad, he always had Al Benson on or somebody else, Big Bill Hill, you know, and he had the blues on. And so I was indoctrinated into it.
What do you think of the blues scene in Chicago now?
You know, I really haven't followed too much lately, so I can't give you an honest answer. I really don't know.
Yeah. Well, one of the great things, Buddy Guy, who is the eldest of the elder statesmen now, one of the great stories is when he first came here, none of the guys like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, they wouldn't let him on stage because they thought he couldn't play. And so you're thinking to yourself, really? Wow. He's the elder statesman around now. Any movie nibbles on this book?
Not yet, but
really?
You know, they're listening.
Involved in that, is there any hope, do you think, Terry Chess, that old, venerable building will ever have a new life? Not as a recording studio, of course, but as the mecca that we've been talking about.
I think it's possible. Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, that it's been honored enough that, I mean, people are aware of it. You know, I mean, when I was there, when Hillary Clinton came in 20 years ago to make it a national treasure, and, you know, it's been made a city landmark, and it's mentioned all the time in the papers, like you say. So I think that at some point, somebody with a lot of money is going to do something to maybe even get that thing up and running as a studio.
Yeah.
Well, would that be something?
I really think it's going to happen at some point.
Renee, that would almost be a dream for you, because you have to be as imbued, not as imbued as Terry is, of course, because his knowledge is all firsthand, sitting, listening to the records in the cars. But it's got to be very meaningful for you, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when the book first came out, we actually threw a party down at 2120. And, you know, some of the people were blues fans, so they got it. They got the significance of why we're there. Other people had no idea. And I'm like, you're sitting right where Etta James recorded At Last, you know. And so I'm hoping that with this new museum coming in, that will actually drive traffic to 2120. You know, like if you go down to Memphis, you can go to Stax, and then you go over to Rock and Soul, and then you go over to Sun. So, you know, maybe music lovers will sort of make that journey.
Some kind of like small tour. Yeah. I mean, you could toss Buddy Guy's joint in the middle of it and have a pretty raucous night out. What's your next historical focus? You don't have to give away too much, but what do you...
I'm actually getting out of Chicago for the next one.
What do you mean?
I'm writing about Helen Gurley Brown and how she resurrected Cosmopolitan magazine.
There's an interesting character.
Yeah.
There is. Why don't you make a meeting between Helen Gurley Brown and Muddy Waters?
I know. You know, that's the thing. I needed to go to something a little bit lighter after the blues book. I was just spent, so.
Is this the hardest book you've written?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Why, again?
Structurally.
Yeah.
You know, three points of view. Just the weight of the material. You know, I had an opportunity to offend people on every page There's a lot of sensitive subjects that I'm dealing with. I wanted to get it right. People really know their music. And so there were a lot of challenges.
Terry, what did your sister Pam think? Did she have an equally admirable reaction to the book?
Yes, she did. Wow. She really loved it.
I must ask you about it. Must sometimes be a heavy legacy for you. Do you ever feel the weight of it in uncomfortable ways?
It's interesting you ask that. Yeah, when I was in broadcasting at one point
in
the city. I ran, you know, WLUP, one of your competitors, I suppose.
I don't know.
But when I was in broadcasting, it was the feeling of big shoes to fill always was in my mind, not only just because of my dad and my uncle. I mean, they're both very imposing figures.
Yeah.
And I felt as if, you know, I had to live up to unsaid expectations. You know, my father never said, you better succeed or you're going to be embarrassed.
Right.
But, they both loomed over me as role models. And so there was a heavy legacy there, even though I wasn't in the record end so much.
Did they ever try to draw you into it beyond taking care of the stock room?
I think it was an unspoken thing that Marshall was going to be in the record end, Leonard's son, and I was going to be in the broadcast end.
Gotcha.
And that's just the way it developed. But as I said, I still felt a heavy burden in filling both of their shoes.
No question. No question.
And didn't Leonard just sort of throw WVON at you? And
SDM, when the loop was still known as WSDM. Yeah, Leonard was the kind of guy that you sank or swim, you sink or swim.
Yeah.
So one day I was 21 years old and was really experienced. I say that sarcastically. And he said, you're going to run the radio station. I'm like, okay. You know, and I really didn't know what I was doing the first few years.
Can say that about a lot of people these days. There are a lot of people running radio stations who don't know what they're doing either. But it was fun?
Yeah, it was. I look back at it as one of the best times of my life.
Interesting. It's a heavy legacy, and some of it, I mean, you can read a lot about Chess Records. I still am not sure that the definitive. Rich Cohn wrote a pretty good book, but Renee Rosen's Windy City Blues will give you a sort of a palpable feeling for not only the place, but also the times, as all of her books do. White Collar Girl, What the Lady Wants. Bob Ferguson, the engineer sitting here, if he reads Dollface, it will be his favorite book. Renee, I can't wait for the next one. But you've really made quite a career, honey, and it's not my place to be proud of you, but I'm proud of you. And Terry, it's always good to see you. And keep fighting the good fight to get
thank you very much.
To get that place the recognition it deserves. We'll be back in after a couple minutes.